Welcome to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. We speak with writers, thinkers, and newsmakers on the controversial issues of human life and human thriving that impact our daily lives. We are exceptional as creatures in the cosmos, as equal members of the human family, and as ethical beings. Humanize explores some of the fundamental questions. How do we thrive? How do we live well and care for what we've inherited? How do we act responsibly with one another and in the wider world? And how do we conserve the good things of this life for the future? We matter. Our actions matter. Let's get into it. I'm Wesley J. Smith, and this is Humanize. Something has gone terribly wrong with American medicine. The COVID pandemic broke the back of trust in our public health officials. There is an affordability crisis. Medical ethics have degraded to the point that doctors no longer take the Hippocratic Oath. Chronic diseases are on the rise, particularly in children. It has all become such a mess. But what should be done about it? Christ famously said, "Physician, heal thyself." Is that the answer? Aaron Carity, MD, thinks it is, and has written an important book, Making the Cut, How to Heal Modern Medicine, that is a fascinating combination of memoir, expose, and advocacy for reform as the author grapples with the most intractable problems afflicting our healthcare system. Dr. Carity is a physician specializing in psychiatry and author of over 100 articles and 5 books. For many years, he was professor of psychiatry at UCI School of Medicine and director of the medical ethics program at UCI Health, where he chaired the ethics committee. He is currently the director of the Bioethics, Technology, and Human Flourishing program at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Dr. Carity has published articles in the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, Newsweek, The Federalist, Compact, Tablet, and First Things. He is a plaintiff in the landmark free speech case, Missouri v. Biden, which went to the United States Supreme Court. He also writes a Substack commentary called Human Flourishing. This is Dr. Carity's second appearance on this podcast. Aaron, welcome back to Humanize.
Thanks, Wesley. Always good to be with you.
Thank you. What is the purpose of the Bioethics, Technology, and Human Flourishing program?
So as the name suggests, we look at new developments in the area of science and medicine and technology. Particularly, many of our programs and projects right now are focused on the effects, the health effects, the psychological and social effects of novel digital technologies, screen time, the emerging developments in artificial intelligence, for example, are areas that we're working on now. And there's an interesting convergence, too, between the issues that we're working on related to tech and big tech and the effects of especially digital technologies on us, because many of those effects are measurable health outcomes, actually. So a lot of the work, for example, looking at the effects of screen time, especially on young people, looks at downstream medical and psychiatric, psychological consequences of.
Give me a quick example of that.
Sure. There's basically, we now have considerable evidence that there's a fairly direct linear relationship between the amount of time that children and adolescents spend on screens, regardless of the content that they're consuming. Obviously, there's some content that's much more toxic and much worse for us emotionally, psychologically, and spiritually than other content online. But studies just simply looking at the amount of time that a young person is interacting with screens show a direct linear relationship between poor mental health outcomes, things like depression and anxiety and addictions, substance use disorders, even really severe outcomes like suicide are correlated with screen time. So there's been quite a bit of work, and my colleague Claire Morrell and others at EPPC have been looking at what are some sensible public policies in the area of education. For example, how do we use screens in the context of schools in ways that will be conducive to health and human flourishing rather than what we're seeing now, which is by and large overall, even though there's obviously beneficial uses of these technologies, I think, including for young people. But the overall effect in terms of how we're using them, how we're embracing them, how they interact with family life and with educational environments is tending right now to produce negative health outcomes, including negative mental health outcomes.
I've even been reading recently of ChatGPT kinds of programs sort of persuading young people to kill themselves.
Yeah, there was a really disturbing case that's been in the news because the parents of this adolescent filed a lawsuit against the creators of ChatGPT. And if you can go online and actually find some of the quote-unquote dialogue, some of the conversation between this chatbot and this young person. And this young man was initially expressing some suicidal thinking, or maybe it was even not as specific as I'm thinking of taking my own life. It was more like maybe my life is not worth living anymore. And this chatbot very quickly sort of steered the conversation in the direction of suicide. And then when the kid expressed ambivalence that, you know, maybe I actually don't want to hurt myself, the chatbot would say things like, well, that's a sort of cowardly way out. It's extremely disturbing to read this back and forth and realize that yes, this machine, this entity that we've created, that we've ushered into the world seems to have pushed this young person who got entangled in this interaction steered him toward self-destruction without anyone's knowledge, certainly, obviously, without the consent or knowledge of his parents. So one of the strange things about AI is that we seem to have created something that we don't, even the programmers, the people who created these large language model AI programs, don't entirely understand how they're working and what they're doing. And they're doing things that we did not anticipate that they would do. And so the question of like who's responsible here is a really difficult ethical question.
Yeah, I've had a couple of shows about AI, and I think I'm going to have to do another one based on what you just said. Let's get back to the subject at hand. You were, you know, one of my first podcast guests. It's been almost, in fact, 5 years or so. This is the fifth season.
Time flies.
Of Humanize. Yeah, no kidding. Yeah. When last we spoke, I went back and looked at our interview. And when last we spoke, you were threatened with being fired from your position at UC Irvine because you refused to take a COVID vaccine.
Yeah.
Since then, a lot has happened in your life. Could you briefly recount that controversy and catch us up to date on what happened?
Sure. So I was at UCI for 16 years as a faculty member, 20 years if you count my residency training there in psychiatry. And when I left, I was about 50% time doing psychiatry and 50% time directing the medical ethics program. That involved chairing the ethics committee, teaching the required ethics course to medical students. And I was involved in a committee that helped develop all the COVID policies for the entire UC system, all five of the branch campuses that had hospitals. Up until the vaccine mandate, which came down from on high, there was no discussion in the committee that had developed all of our other COVID-related policies, which I found disturbing. So I published a piece in the Wall Street Journal arguing that university vaccine mandates were unethical because they violated the principle of informed consent, that with these products that did not stop infection and transmission, the social solidarity argument, you know, even if you're not going to benefit, do it for the sake of others, was considerably, I think, fatally weakened, at least as applied to these particular shots. And that's probably around the time that I went on your podcast. Since then, I filed a lawsuit against the university to challenge the vaccine mandate. And I like to tell people, if you want to go sideways very quickly with your employer, a good way to do that is to sue them in federal court. So even before my case was decided, the university got rid of me. And I think it was a form of retaliation. Allegedly, it was, you know, for noncompliance with the very policy that I was challenging, the vaccine mandate. But they had also worked with other faculty members to help them work remotely or go down to part-time or whatever they needed to do. And they didn't afford me those kinds of accommodations. So, you know, I think it was pretty clear that they got rid of me because they didn't want someone in their midst who was going to openly and publicly in that way challenge what they were doing.
What's really ironic about that is you were arguing, as I recall, that you had had COVID and therefore you had natural immunity.
Exactly.
And they said, no, there's no such thing, basically. And that's what the controversy was about. But you turned out to be correct.
Well, I did. And this is something that I learned in high school biology. This is not some advanced course that I took in medical school or during residency to learn about natural immunity, that vaccines attempt to replicate and imitate natural immunity, but they're never quite as good as actually recovering from infection with the pathological agent itself, which is exactly what had happened. I had a confirmed case of COVID, and I knew that the immunity I had was every bit as good and indeed superior to the immunity conferred by the vaccine. More robust, more long-lasting, better against new variants for all kinds of reasons that we don't need to get into in this show. So it should not have been a controversial opinion, but like so many things during COVID, we tossed out basic ethical principles like informed consent, but we also tossed out very basic immunology and biology, things that have been known since ancient times, the plague of Justinian in ancient Rome. These people understood the principle of natural immunity. They didn't understand the underlying biological mechanisms that could account for it. But they knew if you've recovered already from this illness, you're the best person to basically care for the people who are sick because you're not going to get sick again. So it was a very strange period in public health and in our common life together.
Which sort of led to you writing the book because of the degradation in trust. Public trust collapsed because of some of the very contradictions that you were describing.
That's exactly right. So I wrote a book shortly after I left the university called The New Abnormal, The Rise of the Biomedical Security State. That was a couple of years ago. And that was sort of on the public health elements of what happened during COVID. And the book that we're talking about today, which is called Making the Cut, How to Heal Modern Medicine, that's a book looking at medicine itself. And medicine and public health in the public imagination are often confused today. That's another effect of what happened to us during COVID. But they're two distinct fields, two distinct domains of...
Briefly describe those distinctions.
Yeah. So medicine involves people who are trained to treat illness, whereas public health involves looking at populations as a whole and coming up with things that can try to make a population less susceptible to disease and more healthy. And in fact, the biggest gains in public health have not come about through medical interventions. They've come about through sanitation and engineering, actually, like clean water. And basic sanitation has done a lot to eliminate infectious disease. There's controversies about this, but many public health advocates would argue that vaccines played a major role in that. People who are more skeptical of the current CDC vaccine schedule would say, no, that came about actually through other measures, other public health interventions that were actually more effective. Whereas medicine is about not treating populations as a whole. It's about treating an individual sick patient who's afflicted by an illness and who places himself under the care of someone who is trained and who publicly professes to use his or her knowledge and skills for the purposes of health and healing. And in fact, I think there's two fundamentally different ethical orientations that govern medicine and public health. I think public health it doesn't necessarily have to adopt a utilitarian bioethics, but I think that tends to be the sort of default, the greatest good for the greatest number, which can potentially justify the violation of rights at the individual level in order to achieve that supposed greater good. I think public health is much more prone to adopting that kind of ethical framework, or I would argue unethical framework. And in fact, the history of public health, sad to say, in the United States, in many respects, just is the history of eugenics in the United States. I used to say, well, the two things overlapped considerably, but if you really dig in to the history of public health in the 20th century, it's very hard to disentangle that from the history of eugenics, which went wrong, I would argue, precisely because it adopted this kind of crass utilitarian bioethics. Whereas a traditional, I'll call it a Hippocratic ethic, certainly consistent with the Jewish and Christian traditions in medicine that would affirm the dignity of each individual created in the image and likeness of God. But even prior to Christian revelation, we see in the ancient oath of Hippocrates, an ethic of caring for the sick individual. Into whatever house I enter, I will come for the benefit of the sick, and I will not use my knowledge and skills and power in this relationship where there's an asymmetry of power, where the patient is vulnerable. I won't use my power to exploit the patient. I will maintain confidentiality. I will do everything I can to minimize harm, and I will place my knowledge and skills at the service of health and healing. And I won't do things that contradict those ends or those sort of intrinsic purposes of health and healing. So medicine is powerful. It has very powerful tools. And there's a danger, and there has been, I think, from the beginning, there's a danger of role confusion. I can use my knowledge of pharmacology to heal patients, and I can also use my knowledge in pharmacology to kill patients, as happens in doctor-assisted suicide and euthanasia. And the original Hippocratic Oath, which I would remind listeners, is not an explicitly Christian document. It's a pre-Christian document of pagan origin, specifically prohibits doctor-assisted suicide, and it says, I shall not give a pessary for abortion. So it prohibits actions on the part of the physician that would take a human life precisely to try to inculcate trust that the physician is there for one purpose and one purpose only, and that's to treat illness, to treat disease, and to recognize that, you know, when he or she has reached the limits of our ability to do that and not try to go beyond that and, you know, eliminate suffering by eliminate the person, by eliminating the person who is suffering, for example.
Yeah, we're going to get into to how you have criticized how the current trends in medical care, we're not talking about public health, that actually undercuts what you were just describing in the Hippocratic Oath, because you get into that quite a bit in the book. Just a little bit more introductory, and then we'll get right to the book. You're really now as much a public activist as a psychiatrist, it seems to me. Are you doing both? Are you doing just one? And why did you choose this route?
Yeah. So I still have a small private practice in psychiatry. I do about 10 to 15 hours a week of clinical care, seeing my own patients in psychiatry. But most of my time is now devoted to bioethics and public policy. And I get support from the Ethics and Public Policy Center, and I consult with some other independent think tanks like the Brownstone Institute to work on these issues. So my book, Making the Cut, is one example of trying to contribute. Now, I mean, the book does, I think, essentially three things. One is it's a memoir of medical training, which sort of frames the discussion in the book. And I try to take the reader and place, you know, place the reader at the bedside or in the operating room and really sort of get a feel for what it's like to practice medicine and what it's like to treat and care for vulnerable patients.
I have to say you did quite a good job at that because—
Thank you. No, I appreciate that.
And it's a very varied, because you talk about your training in various areas of medicine and the difficult differences, the differences that you dealt with, including, and we'll get into this, yourself and your wife as a patient.
Yeah, that's right. So even though I specialized in psychiatry during medical school, of course, you get exposed to all different specialties. So there's a chapter in there on, you know, treating dying patients. There's chapters on, you know, helping a woman to deliver a baby on obstetrics and assisting on surgeries during surgical rotations and so forth. So the book is a memoir of medical training, but it's also, I attempt in that context to articulate what I take to be a sound philosophy of medicine, kinds of things I touched on briefly just a few minutes ago. And then in that context, the book, especially toward the end, offers a kind of critique of our contemporary healthcare system in light of what I take to be a sound philosophy of medicine. Where's the healthcare system gone wrong? And what kinds of things might be done to try to address those problems? So yeah, the book is an example of the kind of work that I'm really focused on now, which is sort of big picture, what's happening in the house of medicine, what are we doing well, but also where have we gone wrong? Where have we started to veer from medicine's original purpose? And how do we understand those things so that we can course correct?
You write that your patients are the heroes of your book. Why do you say that?
So the book is, in a sense, it's a lament, but it's also a love story. So I fell in love with medicine during my training. I saw medicine done, in some cases, really, really beautifully and really well. And when you get to be a part of that, when you witness that, when you start to learn how to do that, it's a powerful, wonderful, beautiful thing to be able to accompany patients through their illness and in some cases to help and heal them. And so I didn't really know what I was getting into, to be honest, when I went to medical school. It was a little bit of a default thing that I happened upon. Oh, this seems like a good career, but I didn't go in honestly with eyes wide open. And so part of the story that I articulate in the book is how my eyes were open to just what an amazing and astonishing, sometimes terrifying thing it is to be a doctor and to do the things that we do.
I'm a lawyer and I practiced law for a long time, and I felt the responsibility of people's lives when I took their cases.
Yeah,
and
that's
it would seem to me that even more so if you're a physician, because you're not just talking about circumstances in their life, whether they've lost money, made money, or whatever it might be, they were injured, they need an appeal, they've been charged with a crime, but their literal lives. So the responsibility must be even more profound than for a lawyer.
I think that's exactly right. I think that's very well said. that's one of the things that I try to convey in the book. It's just that sense of responsibility and what is it like to try to carry that. So it's a love story, but I say it's also lament because my lover has turned prostitute. When medicine goes off the rails, it's all the more tragic because, as you just said, the stakes are so high, right? And so when medical education gets overtaken by ideology, you know, the serious consequences of that could not be more profound. So it's very, very concerning when we see a healthcare system that is, as I argue in the book, now aimed more at efficiency than it is at healing. And when we see a medical education system that is caving in to all kinds of political pressure to embrace ideologies that have really nothing to do with the Hippocratic tradition and nothing to do with the essence of what medicine is for.
Yeah, I was about to get into that. Well, give me an example of the ideology you think that has, let's say, afflicted medicine in the way, the ideal way that Hippocrates set forth.
Sure. So the whole idea that the physician's job is to establish social justice, however you want to define that, I think is contrary to the sound philosophy of medicine. Regardless of what you think, let's say, of climate change, it's not the physician's job to solve the problem of climate change. It's not the physician's job to rectify all social inequities. It's the physician's job to treat every sick patient with the utmost care and respect and skill and competence that the physician can muster.
Are you saying that some of the training physicians are getting today in medical school, perhaps, and in continuing education is interfering with that, the delivery of optimal care to individual patients?
I think without a doubt. I mean, we're spending a lot of time in medical education sort of talking about and training young physicians to be social activists or political activists in ways that have nothing to do with the care of individual patients. And, you know, that's a very serious problem. I mean, the infiltration of gender ideology in medicine is also to the point where it's reached absurd heights. I was just reading on social media the other day an account of someone who was saying that, you know, the dean basically walked into their lecture that was being given by a urologist and told this urologist that he could not use the word penis when describing human anatomy because it was exclusionary. The professor responded, well, what term would you have me use? And they said, erectile tissue. And he said, well, the tissue isn't always erect. So that's not, it's not an accurate term. So, I mean, these kinds of just absurdities where we can't use obvious, basic, anatomically correct terms to describe the human body. What could be more basic in medicine than the naming of body parts in anatomy?
Yeah, that's basic anatomy.
So this becomes an absurd distraction from learning what you need to know to be an effective physician and an effective healer. And it also massively undermines the trust that the patient needs to place in the patients. I mean, one of the things, you know, I'm always a little bit wary of jumping straight to the Nazi analogy because it's sort of overused. You accuse your intellectual adversaries or your ideological opponents of sort of acting like Nazis. But the absolutely sort of historically accurate and grounded fact of what happened to medicine during the Third Reich. And by the way, it started a couple of decades before the Nazis came to power with the rise of the eugenics movement in the UK and the United States, influencing eugenics attitudes in Germany. But essentially what happened was that this metaphor took hold that the physician's job was not the treatment of the individual sick patient, but the health of society as a whole. This goes back to that utilitarian bioethics that I think is public health seems more sort of tempted by and prone to. That this metaphor took hold in German medicine in the 1920s and the early 1930s, that our job is to treat the social organism, quote unquote, or the health of the Volk, the people as a whole, and not the individual vulnerable sick patient in front of me. And so when you have that metaphor take hold of the imagination of the medical profession, what happens if you have a cancer that is undermining the health of the organism as a whole? Well, the physician carves out the cancer and gets rid of it to restore the health of the organism. Well, that allows that metaphor of treating society allows you to begin seeing some members of society as a kind of cancer, right? The economically disadvantaged, the physically or mentally disabled are a cancer on the body politic. And so what do you do with the cancer to restore the health of the social organism as a whole? Well, you carve it out and you throw it away. And that, so that led to first forced sterilization and eventually the euthanasia program.
It created a dual mandate, you know, take care of the patient, but also take care of the state and the society.
Exactly.
And what's very interesting, that destroys equality, which Hippocrates, as we discussed, really supported, because one of the, I think, most amazing aspects of the oath is that Hippocrates said you have to treat the master and the slave the same.
Yeah,
I mean, that's a radical statement for 500 BC.
That was revolutionary. Yeah, exactly. These people who were not supposed to be accorded due respect or equal rights when it came to the physician is not allowed to exploit the slave any more than he's allowed to exploit the freeman for his own interests.
Yeah.
Which is extraordinary.
Really, to me, was really interesting. Is part of this being pushed, and I think the utilitarian temptation, if we will, in healthcare is being promoted in many of bioethics approaches, the mainstream view, unless you have a modifier in front of the term bioethicist, such as Catholic or pro-life or whatever, you often will have people who are promoting utilitarian-ish, at least, kinds of concepts, a quality of life versus a equality of life, that kind of thing. Peter Singer is the classic example of the utilitarian bioethicist. Is part of this being driven by how healthcare is paid for and how expensive it has become?
I think that is a significant part of it, is some people within, I'll call it, you know, mainstream or establishment bioethics, have even started saying the quiet part out loud when it comes to economic reasons for embracing a utilitarian bioethics. So, for example, we know that the euthanasia regime in Canada has just sort of leapfrogged over the usual gradual process of expanding people who are eligible and very, very quickly moved toward essentially death on demand. You don't necessarily need a terminal illness anymore to avail yourself of euthanasia. You don't even necessarily need a medical illness. There have been cases reported of people that only had a mental illness like autism dying by euthanasia without the knowledge.
You've seen that in Belgium and the Netherlands as well.
So you see that in certain European countries that have been doing this for a longer period of time.
And then the conjoining of organ harvesting, which adds to the objectification of the patient.
Exactly. And the economic interests at work there, because those organs can be very valuable and lucrative for hospitals and the healthcare system. And some people have actually come out and explicitly said and made economic arguments for euthanasia in Canada, saying this is how much it's going to cost society and the healthcare system to care for these individuals who have chronic illnesses or to care for these individuals who have terminal illnesses. And look at how much money we can save if physicians kill them instead. And so that was always, I think, operating sort of behind the scenes, but advocates of euthanasia knew that the public would sort of recoil from that explicitly crass way of putting human life in economic terms. But they seem to be emboldened now to actually start putting this in government reports and in published bioethics journals. It's, as you follow very closely, you have a really important sort of watchdog role to let the general public know what these professional bioethicists are saying and writing about in, you know, peer-reviewed journals that are behind a paywall that no one else would normally read. So you're well aware that these things have been percolating for years, but I think now they've really come out in the open in the last few years in ways that they were sort of kept quiet and away from public view.
Yeah,
even if people were thinking this, they wouldn't explicitly say it.
I've always said that if you want to see what's going to go wrong next in society, read the professional journals, because they have actually been captured by some of the ideology you were describing. New England Journal of Medicine, The Lancet, and others have really gone down the quote woke, close quote road. And it's very frightening. And what adds to this, and we see it really in Canada, is that when you have doctors advocating for this, people are more willing to accept it because of the physician's authority status in society.
I think that's exactly right. Why are people interested in having physicians be the ones to take human life? I think because the white coat, the prestige of the medical profession, the traditional trust that society has placed in doctors kind of lends a degree of a kind of veneer of acceptability, respectability, credibility to a practice that otherwise would seem odious. And so my father likes to joke, why not truck driver assisted suicide? Why does it have to be doctor assisted suicide? But there's there's a lot of truth in that joke. I mean, it's actually a very legitimate question. You could train someone in the course of a long weekend on how to administer a deadly drug, how to administer a poisonous cocktail that would kill a patient pretty effectively. You don't need 4 years of medical training and 3 to 6 years of residency training to learn how to do that. And so, I mean, I've said, I don't think society should do this, but if society insists upon legalizing and permitting euthanasia, I think it shouldn't be physicians that do that. Why not have a trained cohort of thanatologists whose job it is to kill people? Again, I'm not advocating for that, but
of course not.
I'm framing it in that way because I think that takes the white coat off and lets you see what that practice would entail and what it would mean in very clear, sort of naked terms, where we don't throw the mantle of the medical profession over it to make it more palatable.
That was actually Jack Kevorkian's perspective. You remember back in the 90s, he was wanted to set up what he called obituary clinics for euthanasia, and during the euthanasia, organ harvesting, very utilitarian, and doing experiments on people being killed and so forth. Well, let's get back to your book. You have a lot of real case studies, you change the names to protect patient privacy. Give us one or two examples of the kinds of cases you put into the book, why you put them into the book, and why they're important for the listener to understand.
Sure. So I have a chapter, a large chunk of which deals with philosophical and ethical issues around organ transplantation and organ harvesting. And one of the cases that I recount in that book is a liver transplant that I participated on, in which when we learned that there was a liver available and our patient who was on death's door and was waiting for a life-saving organ was going to be informed, I was permitted to go to the bedside and tell her that, you know, you're going to go to the operating room today and get your new liver and you're going to survive. You're going to live, which up until that point, when you're waiting for an organ, there's no guarantees that you're going to get one. That's a good match and that will come in time to save your life. And so that was a beautiful case, a life-saving case, an astonishing procedure. And I described the procedure in some significant detail because I think it's amazing what medical technology has accomplished with something like a liver transplant. It's a remarkable long at that time. When I did my training, at least, it was an 8 or 9 hour long procedure. And so I wanted to impress upon people just how amazing it is that we can save a life in this way. But I complicated that story by raising some, I think, difficult questions around the nature of organ harvesting, around the criteria that we use to determine that someone has died, which is currently in all 50 states. The main criteria we use is brain death, total cessation of all brain functioning. And some bioethicists have raised questions about whether that's an adequate criteria for death. And I've, over the years, become increasingly convinced that the questions that they raise are legitimate. And so it's very important, and people are pushing back against this. It's very important, I think, for the public to trust the organ donation, organ harvesting process to maintain what's called the dead donor rule, that you have to be dead before you take an unpaired organ like the heart, lungs, the liver, that a person can't survive without, and that we don't want to hasten anyone's death in order to get their organs. We want to disentangle the interest in harvesting organs from the interest in caring for patients at the end of life. And those things have become very complex and in some cases very muddied. And people are pushing back against also the process of requiring explicit consent in order to harvest organs. So we have an opt-in procedure here in the United States where the default is I'm not an organ donor unless I explicitly give consent. And I argue in the book that we should maintain that system and not go in the direction of Spain and other countries where the default is I'm automatically an organ donor unless I do something affirmatively to say that I'm not. And there's various reasons that I get into in the book as to why I think we need to maintain an opt-in rather than an opt-out system of organ donation. We have to maintain what I call the logic of the gift, that my organs don't automatically belong to someone else. They're mine until I decide to give them, affirmatively give them away. My body is not the property of the state. It's not the property of someone who, you know, might need my organs in order to continue living. And so, you know, that's what I try to do in the book with an issue like organ harvesting is impress upon the reader that this is actually not a simple question. There's a lot of complex interests and complex issues at stake. And I would like to see the life-saving practice of organ donation continue. But if we don't do it in a way that is ethically sound, that risks undermining the purpose of the entire enterprise. And I think it certainly risks the public's trust in the system, which is absolutely necessary if we're going to keep something like that going.
Now, you won't be surprised to hear that I agree with you on the opt-in versus opt-out. And it's particularly important if healthcare is becoming more utilitarian, as you worry about and I worry about, then if doctors knew, even though they weren't part of the transplant team, if they knew that this person with a very difficult circumstance was going to also be an organ donor, it could affect the quality of care that that person receives, because that becomes an objectification process.
That's right.
Where the patient becomes an object instead of a subject.
I think that's exactly right. And the Department of Health and Human Services has recently investigated and found serious problems with many of the so-called organ procurement organizations, the OPOs, the people who are responsible for assisting the hospital with the consent and the organ harvesting and organ distribution process, that those clear distinctions between the people who are treating the patient at the end of life and the people who are harvesting organs, you don't want the same doctor doing both. You don't want the same people involved in the end of life conversation as are having the organ donation conversation, because you don't want to, in fact, or even give the impression that you're compromising care at the end of life at all in order to hasten the possibility of harvesting those organs. And that, it seems, for at least some of the organizations involved and tasked with doing that, that has become increasingly muddied, and they're stepping over what should be clear ethical lines. And so I'm glad that there's more attention being paid to this issue now, but there does seem to be some sort of corruption of the process that has crept in.
And part of your book's purpose is to try to help pull back medicine that you love from this more utilitarian approach toward a more optimal Hippocratic approach. You do that with several different topics using actual case studies that you were participating in, I think, quite effectively. You also talk about being a patient. You and your wife, you were in a pretty serious auto accident, and your dad and so forth, and things occurred. Tell us about that and what you learned.
Yeah, there's a chapter called On the Receiving End, and it's about being a patient or the family member of a patient. We had a whole year of medical mishaps while I was in training that landed us in many cases in the same hospital where I was doing my training, but as a patient or as a family member. And so that was really valuable. I think it was providential that I was able to be on the receiving end of medical care, even though I didn't enjoy being injured or sick or having loved ones hospitalized.
Yeah, no kidding.
Because it just gives you a totally different perspective than what you see as a physician. And that thing that illness does to us to render us vulnerable, it's not just the direct physical impacts of the illness itself, which can cause disability and pain and discomfort and so forth, but it's the sort of existential experience of illness, the anxiety, the worries about what's going to happen, the reluctance to entirely trust another person that I had just met in the emergency room who says, hello, my name is Dr. So-and-so. I'm here to help you. And I think it's easy for physicians to not understand, or if they have experience of this, to easily forget what it's like to be lying on the gurney in the ER, or to be wheeled back into the operating room for a surgery. And so that chapter is an attempt to get at the nature of illness through personal experience in order to round out what I take to be the central feature of medicine, which is the doctor-patient relationship. So I argue in the book that at the center of medicine is not a novel technology, even though technological developments in medicine have been astounding and in many cases really beneficial. But at the heart of medicine, we still have something that goes all the way back to the Hippocratic physicians, which is a patient made vulnerable by illness and a doctor who professes to use his or her knowledge only for the purpose of healing, entering into this relationship, this alliance, in order to try to produce a good healing outcome. And there's many forces in medicine now that would threaten to undermine the nature of that relationship, the decision-making process that has to occur between a doctor and a patient, and to substitute some other model of medicine, that medicine is a consumer-driven process, or that the physician is merely a sort of technician of medical power. Right? This is another competing model that says
an order taker.
So that patient autonomy wrongly understood. I think there's an appropriate way to understand the principle of autonomy, but autonomy understood as give the patient whatever they want. It threatens to undermine good, sound medical practice. There's this notion that if something is technically feasible, if it can be done by the doctor, and if the patient is demanding it and there's someone willing to pay for it, an insurance company or out of pocket, then the physician has to do it. The physician can't exercise conscience rights to say, no, I don't think this is actually a good healing action. And so I'm not going to suggest it. I'm not going to offer it to a patient, which is a perfectly appropriate and necessary thing for physicians to do, to exercise that discretion to say, no, my job is to heal you and not to harm you. And if I perceive that this is going to do harm, then I'm not required to do it.
This is the medical medical conscience controversy.
Exactly.
The question becomes, if a patient asks for something that is legal, let's just use assisted suicide, that the doctor objects to either on religious grounds or moral grounds, the question then becomes, is the doctor required to give the patient what the patient wants? In Canada, in Ontario, the answer is yes, that the doctor, patient comes in, is qualified to be killed under the law, because in Canada, it's lethal injection by the doctor. Then the doctor can't just say, no, I don't participate in that. The doctor instead has to create what's called an effective referral. That is, procure the doctor he or she knows will be willing to kill.
Do it.
Making that first physician complicit in the homicide of a patient. So you and I would say that's untenable. It's immoral. It violates the rights of the physician and their moral conscience and often their religious free exercise of religious liberty. The utilitarian bioethicists and many in healthcare today say, no, no, you are discriminating against a patient when you refuse to give them what they want, so long as it is legal. And I think Ezekiel Emanuel, although he hasn't said it about assisted suicide, but he has said it about abortion and some other issues, is a proponent of that approach. And do you discuss this in the book?
I do. And in fact, I think there are strong arguments against Emanuel's position that in other areas of medicine, even proponents of that model of medicine would agree that there's certain things that the physician is not required to do. So a simple example would be a patient comes into the emergency room claiming to have a serious pain condition and demanding a prescription for opiate medications, right? If the physician does a thorough evaluation and determines either that the patient doesn't have a pain condition that warrants opiates, or the patient stands to be harmed by this because he has an addiction or dependency problem on these medications, and that the risks outweigh the potential benefits, the physician is not required, even though it would be legal to do so, the physician is not morally or ethically required to become a vending machine for Vicodin or Percocet and just to give the patient whatever they want. And I think almost everyone would agree that that would not be either something necessary to force on the physician, and in fact, that it would not be medically or ethically appropriate for a physician just to become a vending machine for opiates if that was, in his medical judgment, going to harm the patient. So somehow we can accept that in most other areas of medicine, but we pick and choose a few things like assisted suicide or euthanasia or the prescription of contraceptives or what have you, that tend to be sort of neuralgic flashpoints in cultural debates. And we say, well, we're going to force physicians to do this, whether they want to or not. And in fact, whether they think it constitutes sound medicine or not. And I mean, another aspect of this debate, I think it's important to highlight, the physician may have religious objections to a practice like that. And on those grounds alone, there's reason to respect the physician's conscience. But the physician might just think that this constitutes bad medicine, that medicine is about health and healing, and it's not about killing the patient, for example. And so just on the Hippocratic principle of using my knowledge and skills only for the purpose of healing, I cannot do that. I mean, that's the basis of, there's been pressure for the American Medical Association to change its positions. It's come close, or at least temporarily at times, kind of flirted with the idea of changing its position. But still to this day, the AMA maintains the position against assisted suicide and euthanasia, at least at the national level. It maintains the position that physicians should not participate in capital punishment in torture. It doesn't take a political position on capital punishment itself, but it says, as a physician, you shouldn't use your knowledge and skills to take human life, because that undermines the trust that the patient and the public as a whole would have in medicine. So I think what you see in the debates about conscience, if you sort of pull back and examine the underlying issues, are two fundamentally irreconcilable views of medicine. One I will call the Hippocratic paradigm, which is the one that I've tried to describe. And the other is the sort of technocratic paradigm, which is medicine is a set of tools that can be used for all kinds of different things. Sure, it can be used for healing, but it can also be used for killing. It can be used for reshaping and remaking the human body any which way I want. And I think we have to resist that second paradigm, which threatens to undermine the integrity of the medical profession.
It's very interesting. You know, I don't want to get political with this question. I want the answer from a physician's perspective. Secretary of Health and Human Services Robert Kennedy has popularized the term MAHA, Make America Healthy Again. And that's become quite a controversial issue. Kennedy has discussed the incredible increase in chronic conditions, particularly among children. Of course, he has a reputation as being a vaccine skeptic and so forth. Politics aside, do you think that MAHA movement is onto something?
I do. And there can be plenty of debates, and I would have plenty of debates at the level of particulars, at the level of sort of what to do about the problem. But I think it's very difficult to doubt that we're in the middle of a chronic disease epidemic right now. And that while we've made some progress treating acute illnesses and some progress treating some chronic illnesses, there's been a rise of clearly obesity, metabolic related illnesses, Alzheimer's, type 2 diabetes, cancers that are associated with metabolic syndrome and obesity are currently on the rise. Colon cancer in young people, which is not something that we saw in significant numbers a couple of decades ago. So something is going wrong with the health of Americans, that we spend twice as much as any other developed nation on healthcare, and we get overall outcomes that barely break the top 50 when it comes to overall health of Americans in the United States. I don't think all those problems can be laid at the feet of medicine. I think there's environmental issues, there's issues with our food supply, and again, particular debates about seed oils and vaccines and the nature of different potential toxins in our food, plenty of room for disagreement on those issues. But I think big picture, the MAHA movement has done a service in drawing our attention to the fact that we're not healthy. We're not getting a good return on our investment in terms of medical research and medical interventions in the United States. And so let's have a public conversation about what might be done about that. To me, that's a positive development.
You said that the patient is actually the primary healer and not the doctor. What did you mean by that? And how can patients help their doctors do a better job of helping them heal themselves?
Yeah, so there's a philosophy and a view of the human person that sees us basically as a complex machine. This is a sort of materialist, reductionist, mechanistic view of the human person, that when the machine breaks down, the doctor's job is to sort of intervene and open up the hood and fix the broken parts of the engine to get the patient working, to get the machinery working again. And I think this is a flawed understanding of the human person, of what a living organism like a human being actually is. And a better understanding is that the human body is an organized, coordinated, beautifully orchestrated, intrinsically driven whole that is oriented by nature toward health and healing and human flourishing. And the physician's job is ancillary. The physician's job is to assist the body to do what it otherwise wouldn't be able to do on its own. But the body itself is the primary agent of healing. I'll give you a couple of simple, concrete examples of that. So antibiotics, which are a wonderful development in modern medicine, even if they're overused, even if we're breeding strains of bacteria that are antibiotic resistance through overuse of these drugs. But no one wants a world without antibiotics. They're a wonderful advance in medicine. But antibiotics alone do not clear infection from a body. They lower the infectious burden sufficiently that the body's own immune system can then take over and eradicate the infection, which is why...
I didn't.
Well, if you give antibiotics to someone who's too immunocompromised, it won't get rid of their pneumonia, for example, because the immune system has to work at a sufficient level to kind of do the final cleanup and the final act. So we say surgeons close a surgical wound. Well, they don't actually heal a surgical wound. They take sutures and they adhere the tissues together such that the body itself can actually heal the surgical wound. And again, there's things that get in the way of the body doing that well and that will prevent adequate wound healing. And unless we get the body to the point where it's able to do that on its own, you shouldn't do surgery because the person's not actually going to be able to heal from the surgery. So those are two simple examples to illustrate how medicine's role is sort of the midwife or the handmaiden of the healing process, and the doctor is not the primary agent of healing. And just overall, I think we need a shift in our mentality that would help people sort of reappropriate responsibility for their own health and certainly turn to medicine when they need assistance, but also recognize that there's a lot that is within my own power that I can do to help heal and to help maintain health.
When I was practicing medicine, I'd be in jail. When I was practicing law, I tried to impress on my clients that, yes, I'm there to help win your case or whatever it might be, but you have responsibilities as well. For example, I said, you have to tell me the full truth. And often when clients got in trouble, it's because they didn't do that. And you have to carry yourself in a deposition or in trial in a certain manner. You can't stand up and start screaming and getting emotional and so forth. Do you have the same kind of advice, obviously, for medicine instead of law for patients?
Absolutely. I mean, we talk a lot in medical ethics about the physician's responsibility to the patient. That's obviously important. If this relationship goes sideways, patients stand to be harmed more than physicians. Just like in the lawyer-client relationship, your client stands to be harmed a lot more than you do if this doesn't go well. So the client or the patient in these relationships is more vulnerable than the doctor or the lawyer. But for all that, the patient still has certain responsibilities. I would say they're analogous to what you just described with your clients. If the patient doesn't tell me the truth, then it's going to be hard for me to make an accurate diagnosis and to really know what's going on and then to recommend the appropriate course of treatment if we don't have an accurate diagnosis. So truth-telling, honesty, disclosure, and a basic degree of respect and human regard. So I tell the story in the book, for example, we got an ethics consult when I was at UCI from one of the surgeons on the burn unit, I think it was. And she asked, do I need to continue seeing this patient? And the patient was really abusing her in nasty ways. It's kind of gross, but she would walk into the room and the patient would bite off a piece of his gangrenous finger and spit it at her.
Oh.
And so our response was, no, you're not required to continue seeing a patient who's sort of abusing you in this way. You're permitted to recuse yourself from the care of this patient. So patients do have some degree of responsibility for basic
not
human decency and respect.
Gangrenous pieces of finger at the doctor would be one of them.
That would be one of them. You never know what you're going to encounter in medicine when you're dealing with human beings. So yes, I think at the basic level of truth telling, but also at the level of taking some degree of responsibility for their care. So I tell a story in one of the early chapters of a man who's brought back from the brink of death by a cardiologist performing CPR and a cardiac code on a patient. And the doctor saved this guy's life. And I was very impressed. I'd never seen anything like that before. This is very early on in my training that I witnessed that code blue. And so I thought the doctor would be pretty happy about that afterwards, but he seemed dejected and demoralized. And basically what he said was, it's only a matter of time. You know, this man will not take responsibility for his health. He will not follow my recommendations. He will not do basic lifestyle changes to help him, you know, to help his heart heal. And the family keeps turning to me and saying, why don't you fix him? Why don't you fix him? And my powers are essentially limited if the patient doesn't do his part to cooperate with treatment recommendations and the treatment program.
Yeah, for example, people who might be dying because of alcoholism refusing to stop drinking, you can't
exactly
prevent the liver from finally failing.
Exactly, precisely.
You also get into some reform. We're almost out of time. I'm sorry, it went really fast. You advocate creating parallel medical institutions to the one that exists today. What are the ones that exist today that you think are failing and that parallel institutions should be created? And why do that? Isn't that just reinventing the wheel?
So I think medicine today has been overtaken by the ideology in the book that I call managerialism, which is experts situated at the top with access to expert technical knowledge can and should be put in charge of everything. And so we get top-down managerialist control in medicine. And it actually matters very little whether that top-down control is coming from government bureaucrats in a single-payer government-run healthcare system or, you know, in Medicare, or it's coming from people at the top of large corporate conglomerates that are swallowing up local medical institutions like hospitals and clinics and trying to dictate care from the top down. In either case, you get the physician's appropriate clinical judgment, physician's appropriate discretionary latitude constrained by basically dictates from the outside that don't allow physicians to tailor care to the individualized needs of their patients. And the system has become so entrenched within contemporary medicine that it's so hard to operate within it in a way that's conducive to good medicine, that at least in many cases, what's necessary is for physicians and nurses to opt out of that perverse system and to build something small scale and decentralized on their own. And I give a few examples of that in the book, like direct primary care, for example, which is a more affordable version of what you might call concierge practice, which is typically only available to people who can pay quite a bit out of pocket to get that level of individualized care. But there's other models to make that kind of thing more affordable, to cut out the bureaucratic middle manager that is siphoning off and sucking up so many medical resources and increasing the costs of healthcare, but also contributing to a system in which things are overregulated and overconstrained. We do need some state level and federal regulation in medicine.
Of course.
Naturally. But I think the pendulum has swung so far in the direction of overregulation that we need what I call a parallel polis, which is a concept I take from Czech dissidents under Soviet communism in the 1970s, actually, and try to apply it to the kind of thing that's necessary, I think, in medicine now to free up physicians to essentially sort of run novel experiments in how to deliver and pay for healthcare in ways that are conducive both to good medicine and to making healthcare more affordable.
You know, that's a huge issue. I mean, socialized medicine leads to rationing and leads to long waits. In Canada, some people have actually asked for euthanasia because they couldn't get an oncologist after being diagnosed with cancer. On the other hand, corporatized medicine sucks a lot of resources out of patient care and leads to some of the same issues. So, you know, I know your book isn't about health, the economics of healthcare, but that really has become an important issue. Finally, you're part of something that's just being formed called the Hippocratic Society. What is that?
So thank you for asking about that. That is a new medical society that is staying away from issues that have nothing to do with medicine that are infecting many of our other professional medical societies like the AMA or the American Psychiatric Association. And we're focused on issues related to what constitutes good medicine and helping inculcate in medical trainees and students and residents, young physicians, a sound philosophy of medicine. Our curriculum focuses on the development of virtues. So it's a sort of virtue ethics based curriculum where there are case discussions focused not so much on what is the appropriate diagnosis or what's the right treatment plan, which is usually how case discussions go in medical school, and focus instead on how do we live a particular virtue in the context of treating a patient like this. And so we have our goal in the next 10 years is to have a chapter of the Hippocratic Society at every medical school in the country. And we're only a year or two old, but we already have a couple of dozen chapters at schools around the country. So if listeners are interested or they know medical students and residents who may be interested or faculty at a medical school who may be interested in mentoring one of these groups, they can go to HIPPSOC.org, which is our website, and see if there's a local chapter at your medical school. And if there's not, there's information there about how to reach out to us to get help in starting a chapter at your medical school. And really, this is an attempt to get back to the basics and the core and the essence of what it means to be a good physician. And there's definitely a hunger for this among medical students who sort of want to return to that which originally drew them to the practice of medicine in the first place. And if they feel like they're not finding that or they're not getting that in the course of their medical training, the Hippocratic Society is something that can, where they can find like-minded people and also engage in some of the ethically controversial topics that have become sort of forbidden on campus. So, you know, we don't lead with sort of neuralgic culture war issues at the Hippocratic Society, but we also don't shy away from discussing controversies and hosting events where we present two sides of a debate, let's say around something like doctor-assisted suicide or so-called gender affirmative care, what I would argue is more accurately termed sex rejecting procedures. So some of the conversations that are not happening on medical school campuses, we're hoping that the Hippocratic Society can facilitate some of those discussions maybe in a way that's analogous to what the Federalist Society has done in legal education.
And maybe offer a safe space for people to discuss these things.
Exactly.
Yeah. We'll put the link to the Hippocratic Society in the program notes. Well, we're out of time. It was very interesting. I think you've written a very good book. It's called Making the Cut, How to Heal Modern Medicine. What next for Dr. Carity?
So I have two books in the pipeline, a little bit of a departure from the most recent two. One is on an Italian philosopher named Augusto Del Noce, who's not well known in the English-speaking world. And it's a primer, it's an introduction to his thought. And the other book is actually an explicitly theological book on the Christian meaning of suffering in the cross. That book will be published by Creed and Culture next September. And then a few months after that, the book on Augusto Del Noce will be published, looks like by Catholic University Press. So I got two books in the pipeline, and I'm doing some consulting for the Department of Health and Human Services and continuing to work on other sort of topical bioethics issues. So staying busy and having a lot of fun with it.
Well, congratulations. UC Irvine Medical Center firing you has actually helped you. And I look forward to talking to you again, maybe when your next books come out.
Terrific. Thanks, Wesley.
Thanks, Aaron. Take care. Thanks for listening to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. Discover all the good work of the Center on Human Exceptionalism by visiting discovery.org/human. We can only do this work, speaking on behalf of human life, human thriving, and our exceptional place in this world and our cosmos, with your support. We invite you to make a one-time gift today and to consider starting a monthly gift to support the Center on Human Exceptionalism and this show. Wherever you're listening to Humanize, please take a moment to rate and review the show. You matter. Your actions matter. Be bold, be exceptional, and be back soon.